You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 19th, 2022, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
How's everyone this week?
I'm good today.
Pretty tip-top.
So we get a lot of questions about what we are reading. So maybe at the top of the show, instead of bantering about something random, we'll talk about what's everybody reading at the moment.
Yay.
It's on random.
Is everybody reading something at the moment?
Oh, yeah. Well, I always got something keyed up.
I want to see, out of the five of us, how many are reading fiction and how many are reading nonfiction right now? I'm nonfiction.
I'm fiction right now.
I am nonfiction, but I had to put the book aside because tax season for me. So I really have every minute I spend working on, you know, work. So I'm in a tough time right now.
Yeah, I go back and forth. I just finished a fiction series, and now I just started a nonfiction book, What Remains.
What is it? What Remains?
It's a book about forensic science.
Ooh.
It's cool. It's about death. You would like that character all into death.
Yep, but
also like physical death, and also like and forensic science, like as an investigative tool, like solving mysteries with forensic science, which sounds cool.
I like that.
I just finished reading the same series I believe that Bob is reading right now.
Yeah, so this is by Drew Hayes, who did Superpowers, but this is based in a world of basically, you know, D&D and adventuring, but with so many twists, and it's not what you think at all. Highly recommended. This is the fourth book. I'm almost done with the fourth book. Steve and I just plowed through them. It's really, I mean, it's Drew Hayes, the guy, excellent. He's one of my favorite authors. Fantastic series, highly recommended. If you have played D&D and tabletop gaming, adventuring, there will be lots of in-jokes that you will love. But yeah, I guess you don't need to have to know much about it at all to really enjoy it. Just great stories.
What's it called, Bob?
It's NPCs.
NPCs.
The series.
Non-player characters.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the series name is, but the first book is NPCs by Drew Hayes.
I think that's the series name is NPCs.
As well, okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Right after tax season, I'll get all over that.
It's a fun, quick read. Like if you're looking for something just to turn your brain off and just enjoy some fun storytelling, it's good.
What did you put to the side, Evan?
I'm reading Gerald Posner's book, Pharma. You know, we had him on a few months back, and I finally did order the book, and it came in right before Christmas, so I cracked into it. All about the Sacklers, you know, that whole insanity.
Yeah. Don't get me started.
I haven't gotten too far, but I'll pick it up again soon.
Very cool.
So I got two things percolating. You know, Bob recommended I read or listen to Superpowers. So I have that as a book on tape, you know, that, and that's good for certain times, you know, like if I'm driving or if I'm in the shower or whatever, like I'll throw that on.
Nice.
But you know why? Because of the Dune series, you know, the Dune movie made me crack open the first Dune book. I have like four copies of it in my library. I just, you know, it was funny was I haven't read it in such a long time that I actually forgot how he uses language, and I just forgot his way of writing. So I just wanted to re-experience it, and it sucked me right in. I'm like, I'll read a chapter just to, you know.
It's so good.
It's such a good book. It's unreal how good that science fiction is. His world building is phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
And the story is, even if you know the story, it's compelling, you know?
It's definitely a sign of a good author, you know, in the speculative fiction, you know, realm. Mm-hmm. It's that they make you believe the world is real. You know, like you feel like it has enough depth and nuance and connections. Like it feels like the complexity level of a real world. And when you don't achieve that, it's so flat. Like it just completely fails, you know.
It also feels like homework at that point.
Yeah.
Like it's like drudgery to get through when you're trying to go like, who's that person? Why did they?
What is this reference?
Yeah.
I remember together, like we were playing some multiplayer online games, you know, like sword and sorcery type games. And I was looking for a new one because we were kind of burned out on the ones we were playing. I played this one game for like 10 minutes and I'm like, nope. Not gonna do it just because the story, like the background, was so cookie cutter, flat, just generic. All these weird names that don't really feel like any culture. It was like, oh, forget it. I can't do this anymore. This is like such crap. You know, literally lasted 10 minutes. I'm like, nope.
Yeah, I know. Of course, that's the difference between good and bad fiction.
Yeah, Totally.
So I just finished Mary Roach's book, her most recent book, Fuzz, When Nature Breaks the Law. It was really good. If you've never read any Mary Roach, I highly recommend her everybody listening. Great. She's just the best. And at any given time, I'm always reading stuff for school because I'm working on my dissertation. So I'm reading some, like, you know, source material from Heidegger, like some phenomenology books that are really dense and hard to get through. And to give my brain a break, I opened up my best friend gave me, she always gives me the best Christmas presents. And she gives me like a box just full of crap she's collected over the year that reminds her of me. And it's the sweetest. So lots of random things. And she got me a book. She's like, I know you've read this book. You've read this book, haven't you? And I was like, oh my God, I've never read this book, but I've always wanted to. She got me The Emperor of All Maladies by Siddhartha Mukherjee.
Oh, yeah, I've heard about that book.
It won the Pulitzer like 10 years ago. Yeah. And it's got a lot of clout. So he is an oncologist, and it's the way he positions it, and I'm about 80 pages in now, and I'm set, it's a page turner. The way he positions it is it's a biography of cancer. I think is really cool. Yeah, ooh, it's like the natural history of this disease, but he brings it to life through all the different characters who discovered things, who have done research on it, through all of the different specimens, you know, everything from ancient times and ancient writings to today. And it's, it's fascinating.
All right, well, we have a great interview coming up later in the show with Brad McKay, who is a GP in Australia, talking about fake medicine. So let's get right to our main content. Jay, you're going to start us off with a special segment on 5G and airlines. What is the scoop here?
Oh, gosh, this has been everywhere.
Yeah, you may have heard or read about this. This is something that's going around the news cycle. So right now, here's what's going on. 5G, which you should know about because it's infecting your blood and Bill Gates is talking to you through the 5G networks. 5G is about to go live in many places around the United States. It is already deployed in other countries around the world, like, you know, Europe, I think has a lot of areas that have coverage with 5G. But in the United States, there's an issue being raised by airline companies about the fact that 5G was supposed to literally be turned on today. You know, today is the 19th. You know, when you listen to this, it'll be a few days after, but Wednesday, the 19th, of January, 5G was supposed to be turned on. So what the airlines are claiming is that 5G telecoms pose a threat to airline safety. The airlines are calling this a catastrophic aviation crisis. So apparently something big is happening. The idea is that the 5G service is using something called the C-band, and that these particular frequencies could potentially affect a large number of aircraft, which would render them unusable.
So unusable. What?
And yes. Nobody thought about this in advance?
Exactly. I love that.
And it's
not
happening in Europe?
No, but I'll explain it all to you. It'll all make sense. It sounds very confusing. But so the backstory is in 2021, the U.S. auctioned the C-band mid-range 5G bandwidth. I know that sounds complicated, but it's basically a set of frequencies. They auctioned them, and the mobile phone companies spent $80 billion buying the rights to broadcast in this range. Jeez. 5G, right?
Now, just the rights, yeah.
Wow.
The FAA put out a warning saying the new 5G transmissions could likely interfere with aviation instrumentation. It starts to make sense now, right? So the 5G bandwidth is very close to the same frequencies used by the altimeters.
But then why did they sell it to them?
I have no idea. Mm. I don't get it. So let me tell you, if you don't know anything about aviation, let me clarify. An altimeter, they're on all aircraft. They're an essential tool for modern aviation. They do more than relay the altitude, which is very important, right? You need to know the altitude of the aircraft that you're in at all times. But they also interact with the automated systems aboard modern airplanes, like other systems in the plane. And they also help detect wind shear, which is a really big deal. The plane always needs to know what's going on, and the plane will actually perform faster than the pilot can in some instances. You know, the instrumentation will become aware that wind shear is happening and correct the aircraft. So you can't mess with this stuff. If this is true, which I really do think it is, it means that flying into a major U.S. airport in bad weather, like, let's say it's just lightly cloudy over the airport, you know, which is not uncommon, you would only be able to use a visual approach and not use the instrumentation on the airplane. Think about that. Do you want the pilot who's flying an airplane, you know, a commercial airplane with hundreds of people in it to only be using VFR, which is visual flying instead of instrument flying, which is IFR. No, you want them to be using both. You want the person to be using both VFR and IFR to land that monster, right? So it's a big deal. So the telecom companies have responded. They said they're saying that the 5G technology has been installed in approximately 40 other countries and there hasn't been any aviation interference issues. That is correct. It is true. I vetted that, and that is true. The telecom companies...
Problem solved.
Wait, I'm not done, though, because, of course, there's always a little stickler here.
Wait, there's more.
The telecom companies did agree that they will use buffer zones around 50 airports in the United States. Now, what this means is that the 5G technology will basically be turned off within certain area around an airport.
Crap. So we're still going to have bad service at the airport.
Yes. That's the first thing I thought of. So now it's still going to suck at the airport. Yeah. So 5G technology in Europe does not use the same frequency range as the 5G technology in the United States. The United States 5G technology is very, very close to the airline instrumentation. It's too close.
This seems like a problem that not only we could have solved in advance, but that like the actual people who gave them permission to do this should have known.
I agree.
Who is in charge of the radio waves in the United States?
Federal Communication Commission.
Yeah, the FCC. Right?
Captain Radio.
This sounds like a problem at the FCC. Isn't there, I don't know, a database of like all sorts of stuff, especially dealing with transportation where hundreds of people are being put into, you know, metal tubes and sent up to 40,000 feet. You'd think that they would know about the instrumentation and these things. So anyway, after everything I've read, it's a legit concern. You know, I figure that people could test this, right, Kara? There must be a way to test interference, you know, because you get on a 5G local network. You have the instrumentation come within a certain radius of that, and you know right away if it's interfering with it or not. What we do know is that no 5G interference has been detected in Europe.
Yeah, but it's not apples to apples.
I don't know what's happening right now in the United States. As of today, I don't know what the absolute latest thing is. Apparently, they're saying, okay, we're not going to be broadcasting 5G around airports. That might be the only thing that needs to be done. But, you know, maybe they could do some tweaking of the frequencies, moving these frequencies farther apart so there's no interference or not enough, you know, of a signal strength or interference that could really do any damage. But it's a scary thing to get this close. I mean, this week is when the airlines are like, whoa, no, where were you 5 years ago? You know what I mean? I don't get it.
Are you sure it was really just this week that they noticed it or was complaining about it? Or is it just the media got a hold of it this week?
That's a good clarification point, Steve. I don't actually know. I think it makes sense that they've known about it. This seems to have been going back and forth for more than a week. This has certainly been percolating for more than a week. But the only thing I can say is it's important that they use these high frequencies for 5G because the higher the bandwidth, you know, the higher the frequency, the faster the back and forth communication can be. And that's one of the things that makes it, you know, the quote unquote 5G. That's what makes it faster. You also want airlines to be using instrumentation that is communicating super fast as well because, you know, airplanes, you know what I mean? So they'll figure it out. Thank God nothing had happened. You know, thank God nothing, you know, they didn't find out in the rears, which means planes would have been crashing. But it's, you know, it does make you lose a little bit of confidence in the agencies and the organizations that are supposed to be on top of this stuff.
You know what I can't help but think about, and I'm wondering if anybody else is having the same experience right now. The opening episode, season one, episode one of The West Wing, when the president drives his bike into a tree and Toby's on a plane and they send a message to the cockpit and he tries to get on his phone to like call and the flight attendant is like, sir, you can't be on that phone on this flight. And he rattles off like the model of the plane and all of the technology on it. And he's like, you're saying I could flummox that thing with something I bought at Radio Shack?
Yeah.
And it's like, all I keep going back to is like, oh gosh, we got to get our communication in order.
It does humble you a little bit to all of that, like, oh, that's nonsense. It isn't because of the frequencies that are being used. I mean, your phone is doing a lot more now than just connecting over these networks. It has local ways of connecting with other devices. There's a lot of intricacy in these $1,000 devices that we carry around with us.
All right, thanks, Jay. Kara, you're going to tell us about two things I like that go together, zombies and science.
Yeah, except when you put them together, they go wrong. They go very wrong. So there's actually an article, and the more I dug into this, the happier I got, because this article was co-authored in Nautilus recently by Natalia Pasternak and some colleagues of hers. And if you don't know who Natalia Pasternak is, I actually recently had her on Talk Nerdy, and she was recommended to me by Michael Marshall. So she is a very kind of outspoken and well-respected science communicator, and I want to say virologist or immunologist in Brazil, who like testified before their, you know, version of the Senate against kind of all of the pseudoscientific rhetoric that their Ministry of Health and that Bolsonaro have been touting. And so there's a strong, in the article that they wrote for Nautilus, there's a strong like kind of Brazil bias. But I think it's really informative because it really parallels what's going on here in the U.S. And they called this article The Attack of Zombie Science. And the subheading, which is, you know, kind of explains exactly what they're talking about. They look like scientific papers, but they're distorting and killing science. So we often talk on the show about legitimate science, and we often talk on the show about pseudoscience. But what we don't often talk about is this kind of in-between point where, you know, the science is sort of done correctly. Maybe there are some methodological issues. Maybe there were some problems with how, you know, a study was registered or with p-hacking or, you know, with some other, whether it be intentional or unintentional problems. But we don't often talk, I think, about what is the purpose of this research. There's very often a sort of assumption that all roads lead to enlightenment and that all scientific inquiry is equally valid. And the argument that the authors make in this study, and they really link it to COVID-19 and the massive influx of publication that happened around COVID-19, is that yes, there's pseudoscience. Yes, there's junk science, stuff that's patently false, stuff that we can disprove outright, stuff that would never or should never make it into legitimate mainstream journals. And then there's this cultural phenomenon that happens as a result of the publish or perish pressure that a lot of scientists feel, where it's kind of like, I'm just going to do a study, even though I'm not really trying to answer any questions that are valid. I'm not really trying to contribute to a body of knowledge. I'm not trying to better the world in any way. I just think this is an easy thing based on the lab equipment I have, based on what's in front of me, based on the stuff I've published before, to be able to rattle off a paper, get it in this journal, and now I'm keeping up my CV. And sadly, during the pandemic, there have actually been multiple examples of scientists reaching out, very often scientists who volunteer as editors in journals, saying, what is this toxic garbage that is gumming up my inbox, that is preventing me from being able to sift through these mounds of publications and find the legitimate stuff? Like, one of them had a quote, something like, and he wouldn't disclose what any of the studies were about because he wanted to make sure that the authors remained anonymous. Hans Oakes, a professor of pediatrics at the Seattle Children's Research Institute, said, quote, some are material for Saturday Night Live. Ooh. Like, these papers are that bad. Oh, wow. That they're ridiculous. One author said, or one reviewer said, quote, my favorite example is a suggestion to blow very hot air into a patient's lung to eliminate the virus. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And also, sometimes these submissions are actually pushing national propaganda. So sometimes these submissions are things where, like, state-sponsored research from across the globe are saying, this is an approach that we've been taking. Let's look at it and let's see if we can validate it. So there's this institutional response to the pandemic, or there's, you know, obviously all the papers we've seen on hydroxychloroquine, on ivermectin, on things where there is a perfectly large body of literature. Certain claims have already been debunked, but a scientist might say, okay, let me just tweak it and apply it to this new contingency, and maybe I can write a whole new paper about it and publish that. And these reviewers are saying, why are we wasting our time, our money, our experience on basically these zombie science papers. They look like science. They actually kind of are science. They don't fall purely into the pseudoscientific category, but they're basically eating our brains and preventing us from putting energy into the legitimate science that's happening. There, it's a flooding problem. It's a problem of the culture of publication across the globe. And it's actually a legitimate concern that I don't think we often talk about or write about.
Yeah, no, I agree. It could be a huge problem. You know, a lot of it is the as you say, it's the academic culture of, you know, publish or perish. Mm-hmm. You know, there, you've heard of the minimal publishable unit. You've heard that term?
Yeah, Sarah? Yeah, yes. And that's exactly what they're talking about.
Yeah, you're doing research, and normally, you know, you might think you do a study, you get all the results, and you publish a paper showing your results. But if you could get three papers out of that same research by breaking it up, and so the question becomes, how small a piece can you publish? And that's where this idea of the minimal publishable unit is. Mm-hmm. You have to get down to the minimum piece of this, of your research that you can get into a journal. But that's only part of the issue here. There's also, you know, again, this idea that you're just going to, let's reanalyze the data. Let's do, you know, like there's so many ways that you could just generate lots of noise, you know?
Yeah, by just like recontextualizing something or studying it a slightly different way, even though there's no face validity to it anyway. This is not a game changer. This is not a big question in science that people are, you know, it's one thing if, and we see this all the time when we cover stories, you know, the discussion section of every legitimate and illegitimate journal article says more research is needed to answer X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
And, you know, the culture of science should be that people go, oh, that's an open-ended question that people haven't tackled. I want to take up that cause. But more often, the culture of science is my lab has the equipment to be able to answer X. My, you know, my expertise happens in Y. And, you know, some people, I think the vast majority are sort of trying their best to say we're trudging through, we're moving the needle, and we're bringing information to unsolved problems. But there's also a lot of science that's literally like, I'm going to solve a problem that doesn't exist. I'm going to try and answer a question that nobody's asking. And that's the other kind of side of this minimally publishable unit, right? Like not only is how much can I break down the work I've been doing and just like flood journals with it, but also how much can I just pontificate about something that is not actually helpful to anybody and get a publication out of it.
Yeah, it's also, Kara, doing a lot of preliminary research. Rather than you start with the preliminary research, then you do internal replications and you develop it to the point where you know if it's real or not.
Exactly.
Then you publish it. And then at the other end, people will argue, yeah, but you want other scientists to know about what you're doing as soon as possible so they could build on it. And to that, I would argue, well, that's what preprint servers are for.
That's what preprint servers are supposed to be for.
Yeah.
You're right. Yeah.
Share your stuff, but don't freaking publish it until you know it's real. You know, until you've done some, or at least it's probably real. Just need to lower the noise level. But just as a funny aside, so we've been using the term zombie science for years at SBM, but we use it in a different way to refer to.
Oh, interesting.
We use it to refer to things that will not die. Like you think they're dead, then they come back to life to eat your brains, right?
Yeah. Oh, great.
Like the same acupuncture studies over and over again. It's like, oh, didn't we destroy this 2 years ago? Why is there another study doing the same crap over and over again? They just don't go away. They will not die. They're like the Terminator.
And they say something kind of similar, but you're right, referring to something different. And I want to find the specific reference in the article because it's really helpful. We think of zombie science as mindless science. It goes through the motions of scientific research without a real research question to answer. It follows all the correct methodology, but it doesn't aspire to contribute to knowledge in the field. As we know from horror movies, the only way to kill a zombie is to destroy its brain before it devours ours. The same is true for zombie science. As scientists, science communicators, and citizens, we need to recognize this distortion of science and take aim at its methods before it has another chance to distort, harm, and kill. And they specifically are talking about the context of COVID-19 because there has been a flood of the number of publications that have occurred during COVID-19. And it's easy on the outside to go, look at the pace of science. Look at how successful we are. Look at all the great science that's being done. But really, it's sadly a lot of noise with not very much signal inside of it.
Yeah, that's the problem. Too much noise, not enough signal.
Yeah.
All right, Bob, tell us about this new information about the origins of life.
Yeah, this was interesting, obviously, because I'm talking about it. So new research on the origin of life finds conserved protein sequences that could link to the earliest proteins at the dawn of life on Earth. This study appeared in the journal Science Advances. So lots of sciences have a holy grail, right? Or they have multiple holy grails, like physics, for one, has one of their holy grails is developing quantum gravity. So what's the elephant in the room for biology? Now, for biology...
Consciousness?
Yes, perhaps.
That's one of them.
I think biology has a few elephants. The one I'm going to talk about is arguably not, it's not the biggest or the pinkest elephant, but it's still impressive. And it is, how did life start on Earth? How did inorganic matter and chemistry become biology? That's clearly one of the holy grails of biology. So now we know, that life started during Earth's Archean eon during, it's like 4 billion years ago. So now Earthlings have made extraordinary discoveries about living organisms because, Earthlings, we know, right? We know with certainty the broad and even the most minute strokes of how, to borrow Darwin's words, endless forms most beautiful and most wonderful have been and are being evolved. We know that to such a level of granularity. It's one of the grandest achievements of humanity. But how did it all start? What was the spark of life, if you will, and don't tell me it was a deity. What got it going? What was it like? What started this? We have no idea. We've got lots of hypotheses, tons of them. Some are cool, some are interesting, some are outlandish, but there's no real consensus except at the highest level of vagueness. There's really no idea that everyone agrees on that has any specificity. So, well, here's an idea that was recently published. It sounds intriguing enough for me to skip some physics or astronomy news this week and talk about. So the researchers started with a premise. Life as we know it has to gather and use energy, right? That's a very reasonable premise. Most likely back 4 billion years ago, it was photosynthetic or chemosynthetic. And we know what that means at a high level, right? Because photosynthesis, it depends on radiation from the sun. Chemosynthesis depends, it's from the inorganic chemicals that are released from seafloors, for example. But what does that mean, this gather and use energy at the molecular level? What's happening? It means that you can transfer PIM particles. Oh, wait, you're not ready for that. All right, I meant to say electrons. For life to take energy from the environment, it needs to be able to transfer electrons. Bottom line, that's what needs to be done. It seems kind of trivial, but it's absolutely fundamental. Without that ability to remove or add electrons to atoms or molecules, there'd be no photosynthesis, there'd be no respiration, there would be no meatballs. There would be nothing. Our type of biology could not exist. Perhaps no type of biology could. That's how fundamental that may be. If it was some sort of biology or life, I don't think we would call it those two terms. I can't imagine it. That doesn't mean, I'm just a baseline human. What do I know? But without this ability, life is going to have some trouble. Taking that into account, the researchers reasoned that since metal is great at transferring electrons, right? And since proteins handle almost all of the functions of life on Earth, perhaps they should look for the origin of life at modern proteins that bind with metals. Put those two together, maybe that would give you some insight into the origin of life. And that's exactly what they did. So since so many proteins have been minutely and digitally cataloged, they handle this task computationally, which of course is the way things are done these days. So much is online and digitized. Using computers, they compared thousands and thousands and thousands of proteins that bind metals inside them. Generally, I assume in the cores of the proteins, they're binding to metals. So what did this comparison tell them? Their paper relates this, had this good quote. Our analysis reveals that the folds that bind transition metal have similar structural geometry and amino acid sequences across the full diversity of proteins. So that means, what they're saying is that the protein code, if you will, and the structure of the protein that binds metal, it's similar regardless of the protein, regardless of the metal, regardless of the organism. There's huge similarities. A hemoglobin binding iron or a pirate protein binding to gold. It doesn't matter. Of course, I made that last one up, but you get the point. It reminds me of highly conserved genes in our genome, right, Steve? We share many genes with bananas, for example. You don't want to mess with those genes because they're probably incredibly important if bananas and humans have them. So let's see. There's more. Microbiologist Jana Bromberg from Rutgers University said, we also saw that these metal binding cores are often made up of repeated substructures, kind of like Lego blocks, right, Jay? Curiously, these blocks were also found in other regions of the proteins, not just metal binding cores, and in many other proteins that were not considered in our study. So it appears that this universal metal binding code is kind of fractal, right? Like Legos, with small sections repeated over and over, even in other parts of the protein that are unrelated, that are binding with metal. That those were some of their big takeaways from this comparison. So what might all this mean? Researchers conclude that all these shared features, these conserved sequences, could have been part of the earliest biological proteins. Bromberg said, our observations suggest that rearrangements of these little building blocks may have had a single or a small number of common ancestors and given rise to the whole range of proteins and their functions that are currently available. That is, to life as we know it. So that's the money quote right there. So these conserved protein sequences may still exist because they're fundamental to biology, so fundamental that the very earliest proteins or smaller versions of them called peptides used them perhaps to wrangle electrons in the Archean Sea billions of years ago. Okay, so how might that be helpful? Well, obviously, this theory could potentially shed critical insight into how life began on Earth billions of years ago. That's unto itself. That's amazing. I don't need anything else beyond that. But, and that would be one of the greatest discoveries of all time, assuming that it's even possible to have that level of certainty and confidence that you could say,
right.
This is
how do you even really validate
right,
that?
Right. How do you validate it? You'd have to state it with a certain level of confidence. I don't know how high we can get that, but we could potentially say this is a viable method for biology to have been created 4 billion years ago. Maybe it's not what started, our biology, but it's a viable way. So I think they'll be able to say that with some good level of confidence. But there's also some other benefits to discovering this. This could help us fine tune our search for life on other planets, right? If we know how life started on other planet on Earth, and we only have this one data point. So, if we're going to be looking at other planets, the more we know about how life started or biology started on Earth, the better chance we'll have to recognize it or identify it on other planets. Another possibility is that it could also help scientists today working on synthetic biology, right? Since knowing how biology itself started could certainly help making a synthetic version. So I'm sure that could be very helpful. So really cool. Look it up online to get more details, and also look up the Archean Eon, with the first real geologic eon of the Earth. That's a fascinating time. No oxygen in the atmosphere. The crust had just cooled. You could just start walking on the Earth without falling into lava, no matter what step you took. Fascinating time period, very different from today. And it was the beginning of everything and the beginning of biology on Earth.
And it's called the Archean Eon. Why isn't it just called the Archean?
Archean. It's Archean. And it's an eon. It's not like another designation.
An era, epic.
Yes.
Yeah,
right.
But I mean, it seems like they made a portmanteau. Why don't they just stick with the portmanteau?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I hear you. Like,
Kara, let me ask you a question. What do you know about asymmetric oblique trailing edge serrations?
Did you say serrations?
Yeah.
Oblique.
Asymmetric.
Asymmetric oblique trailing edge serrations.
You're talking about knives? Are we talking about knives?
Nope.
Then I don't know.
Oblique, trailing edge, cutting edge serrations.
I'm talking about owls.
Of course.
Owls. Oh, feathers?
Owls.
Their wings.
Yep.
Their wings,
yes.
Not their beaks.
Go on.
See, I'm still, never.
No, I love, legitimate scientific speak, because when used properly, it's both informative and it's poetic. And it sounds so deep, asymmetric oblique trailing edge serrations.
And so concise, too. the concision is fantastic.
And precise, yeah. Exactly. Love it. All right, anyway, so that owls are silent flyers, right?
Right.
Most of them are nocturnal. They hunt little critters, and it's to their advantage to be able to fly as quietly as possible.
I thought that's the leading edge of their wings that caused that. The quiet.
No, it's the trailing.
The trailing,
edge.
Ah.
The trailing.
I've been misinformed.
Most of the noise.
Turbulence.
Yeah. Most of the noise generated by aircraft and wind turbines and birds are caused by the trailing edge noise, you know, the turbulence that happens at the trailing edge of the wing. There's actually been a couple of different independent lines of evidence that serrations, or scalloping is another term I've heard used, tends to reduce the trailing edge noise or turbulence. In fact, you know how like the humpback whales,
they're ridged.
Their main fin, they have that sort of scalloped back edge of their fins. It's the same kind of phenomenon.
Holy crap.
It's all fluid dynamics, right?
Right, right.
Phenomenon.
So the question is, can we leverage studying how owls are able to fly so silently in order to improve our technology? So, like, especially like with wind turbines, as they're becoming, you know, more common on the landscape, one issue is noise. How much noise do they generate? Yeah, it's actually not that big of a problem, but you wouldn't want to live too close to one. And if you're having a bunch of them, there could be noise pollution. So essentially the study that we're talking about is trying to figure out what is the optimal configuration of the trailing edge serrations in order to absolutely minimize turbulence and reduce the generated noise. You could also maximize the lift to drag ratio as well, by reducing the turbulence. So they were able to, you know, significantly reduce the decibels that would be produced, you know, by, say, wind turbine blades spinning, or by aircraft, but by incorporating this specific design of serrations. It turns out that asymmetrical is better than symmetrical, and, you know, oblique rather than perpendicular. They also found that with owls, it's not just the anatomy of their wings that minimizes the trailing edge turbulence. It's how the owls are constantly adjusting their wings.
Oh, they're moving them to make themselves more quiet.
It's dynamic, yeah. Mm. And so what they're trying to figure out is how could we optimally incorporate that into airplane or wind turbine technology. They call this a bionic airfoil. Mm.
Bionic?
I don't know why
I don't like that.
But depending on like which way the wind is blowing, for example, you might want to make tiny adjustments in order to minimize the trailing edge turbulence. If this research comes to, you know, fruition, and again, this study is very, very promising, showing, you know, many decibel decrease in the trailing edge noise, could significantly reduce the noise pollution around airports and around wind turbines, and may also, you know, make these technologies more efficient. They said they were able to reduce the noise by about 10 decibels, which is huge.
Is it?
Is it?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. If you heard like
because decibels are on the log scale, right?
Decibels is a logarithmic scale. Yeah.
Yeah, so 10 decibels is huge.
It's huge.
It's huger than you would think it would be because it's a factor. Okay.
This isn't the first study to look at, you know, owls and why their wings are so quiet. This is for sort of, it's an incremental step, you know, using computer simulations and whatnot to try to maximize the design, not just follow the general shape, but to really dial it in and show how much noise suppression you can get. So hopefully, you know, again, I thought it was neat, and I like when we use nature as a laboratory. You know, the fact that the shape of owls' wings is a result of evolutionary pressures, you know, over a long period of time. You know, that's a lot of information. You know, that's a lot of research happening out there. Think of how many owls have lived over the last millions of years. How many birds, you know, with different pressures on the anatomy of their wings. Yeah. Yeah.
So then we use that and we call that biomimicry.
Yeah, biomimicry. Yeah.
I love that word.
Yeah.
Why not?
It's so good.
I mean, yeah, just capitalize on the millions and millions of years of R&D of nature. Come on.
Yeah. Right? Thank you. We'll steal that intellectual property.
But anyway,
those birds want to make any money off that? Nah. Yeah.
See you in bird court.
Right.
But Bob, to clarify, because you said that you thought it was the leading edge, it's actually a lot of things. It's not. So it's they have multiple anatomical features that make the flying more quiet. It's leading edge. They call a leading edge comb, a trailing edge fringe, a downy wing surface, and a unique wing cross section. So there's all different aspects of their anatomy that minimize the turbulence.
Yeah, I specifically remember years ago reading leading edge design of the wing. But yes, I'm sure it's like a multi.
But apparently the trailing edge is the major contributor to the noise specifically.
Okay.
All right, Evan, you're going to give us another kind of similar thing that in that there's an evolutionary angle to it. Tell us about the evolution of flowers or flowering plants, to be more precise.
Yeah. Are you familiar with the term Darwin's abominable mystery?
Oh, yeah.
What was abominable?
Back in the year 1879, in a letter to his closest friend, botanist and explorer Dr. Joseph Hooker, Darwin wrote, "The rapid development, as far as we can judge, of all the higher plants within recent geological times is an abominable mystery."
Mm-hmm.
So he was mystified.
He was very dramatic, that man.
He had a flair to him,
right.
Which I like. He was mystified. How was it possible that flowering plants became dominant so rapidly in ecosystems across the world? Plants that existed for millions of years without any blossoms, then all of a sudden, in a geologic timescale context, flowering plants seem to have arrived almost out of nowhere, and they spread quite rapidly. This is known as the radiation of angiosperms. Angiosperms are flowering plant life. You know, they bear their seeds and fruit. Angiosperms can be monocots or dicots, right? Monocots, lilies, orchids, grasses. Dicots, roses, peas, sunflowers, oaks, and maples. Gymnosperm examples, that's from which the angiosperms, their predecessor are the gymnosperms, and they are the non-flowering evergreen plants, pine, spruce, fir trees, and so forth. And they represent some of the oldest plant life in geological history. But once the angiosperms appeared, they relatively quickly started replacing their older peers within the span of only a few tens of millions of years, which is technically very short. And to this day, angiosperms are by far the dominant form of plant life on Earth. Now, the major lineages of angiosperms originated 130 to 90 million years ago, and that was followed by a dramatic rise to ecological dominance 100 million to 70 million years ago. Again, a relatively short time. But the problem is it didn't sync with Darwin's theory of evolution. The fossil record challenged, because they realized this in the fossil record from where they were getting these samples, it challenged the slow and gradual modification required by natural selection as a mechanism for evolution. And many of Darwin's critics used those facts against him and his theory for quite a while. Now, one of the possible answer to this puzzle or Darwin's puzzle is that angiosperms actually did evolve much earlier than the fossil record had indicated, but people just hadn't found them yet. They hadn't been realized. Fossilized flowers are very tough to discover because the fossilization process is long and it's not easy on the delicate nature of the flower material. But Darwin admitted he never much liked having to defer to that as a possibility. It seemed more like an attempt to deflect the detractors than really being a serious scientific answer to a problem. So this kind of haunted him. And this was the abominable mystery that Darwin is quoted as having written and has, you know, come to have been known in many science circles. But as time marched on, and so much more of the fossil record had been discovered and mapped out over these past several, you know, well, this last century and many decades, there have been a few fossil discoveries of flowering plants that have been dated to the pre-Cretaceous times. There's an example discovered in 2016 out of China, a fossilized flowering plant from the Jurassic period 145 million years ago. So prior to that, 130 million years ago. And then in 2018, another sample in China discovered dated to 174 million years. Ooh. But those samples were in some level of dispute because it was questionable as to whether or not there were true angiosperms. But now, and here's the news item, early 2022, we have a report on a new fossil found in China dated to at least 164 million years ago, and it is considered to be a true angiosperm. This was a new study published in the scientific journal Nature, Ecology, and Evolution, where a team of scientists from Switzerland, Sweden, the UK, and China have shown a sample of a flowering plant that originated in the Jurassic. Many more millions of years earlier than the oldest undisputed fossil evidence. The name of the specimen is called Flora germinus jurassica, dated to more than 164 million years ago. It's said to be without a doubt a true angiosperm specimen, judging from the presence of the flower bud, connected fruit, and leafy branch. It is the earliest fossil of a flower bud yet discovered. So this does not put to bed the question or the mystery or the solve the case, as it were, and you can close it. But it seems to be an important piece of the puzzle. And Darwin appeared to be at least partially right, if not mostly right, is that it just had not yet been discovered because these flowered plants you know, are so delicate, they don't really fossilize all that well. And therefore, there's so many fewer specimens to be found.
Yeah, but wouldn't a solution also be that that evolution is not gradual?
Right, that there are explosions when there are big open niches to fill?
Yeah, this is the punctuated equilibrium thing. Also, like sometimes, you know, a clade will hit upon something, a strategy for of survival that just works really, really well, like flying. And so then once birds hit upon flying, they just exploded evolutionarily because it was just a really successful strategy that they hit upon. So I would imagine that, you know, flowers could be the same thing. It was just a really successful way for them to spread. And so they spread like crazy and there was adaptive radiation and just, you know, evolution took off.
Like we have a lot of examples of that, don't we?
Yeah.
In the fossil record?
Maybe I'm missing something in this specific news item, or maybe it's just bad science reporting on whoever wrote it up. It's just the idea that, you know, yeah, Darwin had a problem with that, but we, you know, the evolutionary theory today in the 21st century is not the classic Darwinism of the 19th century. You know what I mean? Darwin's basic conception was of this continuous gradual change. That's no longer the leading theory of evolution.
Yeah, he was the first. Well, he and Huxley.
Right.
They were the first to talk about this. It wasn't going to be perfect.
Right, of course not. It needed to go through refinement, more discovery, more independent lines of evidence and everything else.
No, I mean, I just think it just should be framed a little bit differently in terms of like what this actually is solving.
Yeah, I think the real kind of takeaway here is, holy crap, flowering plants came a lot earlier than we thought. Or, you know, Darwin thought maybe they did come earlier, and hey, look, they probably did.
What might have happened, I mean, I have to take a look at it a little bit deeper myself, Evan, but what I suspect may have happened here is that this study has nothing to do with Darwin. It's just that whoever was writing it, that was the hook that they found, even though it doesn't really jibe with modern evolutionary science.
No, it's just about the discovery itself, because whereas the prior pre-Cretaceous specimens, they weren't 100% sure that these were, you know, fully realized to be the Angios. But this one, they said there's no doubt about it. This is like the concrete example. This is absolutely, absolutely an angiosperm.
You know, like the graphs in the textbooks have to be changed. Like those kinds of discoveries are really cool.
Right. 130. You just jumped from 130 million years to 164 million years.
Yeah, exactly.
34 million years. Tack it on.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy Time?
All right. So just in case you don't like weird sounds, be careful with this one. But this was a sound I played last week. Check it out. Okay, guys, any guesses?
Was there a voice in the background?
There is a voice in the background.
Is that relevant?
I would say yes. Every clue is relevant.
Ooh.
I'd say it's not organic. It's like technological.
I think that's a good assumption. All right. Well, we got a listener named Eric Bonin, and he wrote in, I usually listen too late in the week to submit a response, but this week I made it a point to find Who's That Noisy in the download and listen to it first. That is pretty smart, Eric. This sounds like a motorized punch, possibly punching out patterns in leather. You know, I understand what you're getting at, because this could be like a machine in a factory that's doing a repetitive task. But there is that weird voice that comes in about halfway through, which, you know, would take away, I think, from that idea. So
unless the voice was just somebody in the background at the factory, but you're saying the voice is part of the noisy.
Well, yeah, it is. It's one of the clues. Another listener named Gary Record wrote in and said, hey, Jay, this is probably going to be a common answer, but this week's noisy sounds to me like a helicopter. The main noise being the blade spinning overhead. I seem to also hear a sound in the background like voices talking over a radio. I think this is a pretty good guess. I mean, it does kind of have that repetitive helicopter flap, flap. And yeah, you know, the voice in the background could be someone over the radio or whatever. Not a correct guess, but definitely getting closer to the mark. And by coincidence, the next person's name is Mark Constantine, and he wrote in, hi, the noisy this week sounds a whole lot like a tattoo removal laser.
Ooh.
I have vivid memories of that laser zapping the all aboard ratio I had on my womb raider. What?
All aboard on his womb raider.
So he got he got a tattoo on his womb?
What? We're not.
No, his womb raider.
No.
That's really funny, though. It said all aboard. Good for you for getting that removed, Mark. Gosh, I hope he doesn't have firsthand experience of that, because I hear those are so painful.
Yeah, so I've heard a tattoo removal laser. You can easily hear one yourself on YouTube. They do have that kind of sound. But then again, we have that strange voice in the background. Who is that? Is that the person operating the laser that is talking in such a weird monotone voice? I don't know. But good guess, that not the right answer. We have another guess here from Nick Hilton. And Nick says, is that a recording of Pulsar radio pulses? That's a pretty cool guess too, right? And I've heard like this type of thing before that does have that kind of sound, but that is also not correct. We have a winner this week. The winner is Gavin Stewart. And he said, hi, Jay. My guess is the woodpecker.
What?
Do you guys recognize that before I tell you everything? Do you recognize what the woodpecker is?
Like the cartoon?
No. So this is a Soviet shortwave radio based over the horizon radar. So this is one of those big metallic structures that you've probably seen pictures of that, you know, transmit radio frequencies, like transmit signal and they're there for a reason, you know, and the Soviets built them. I also think that the United States had built something like this. So let me give you a little bit more detail. So this is from the original person, Steve X, who wrote in. He said, the Duga over-the-horizon radar built and operated by the Soviets in the Ukraine near Chernobyl from 76 to 89. This thing was so annoying to shortwave users that some radios came with a woodpecker blanker. So to explain what that is, it would get rid of the noise that was coming from this gigantic monstrosity was sending radio waves. Now, that voice you hear in the background is actually somebody telling the time. If you listen closely, they're just telling you what time it is.
Is it in Russian?
Let's listen to it again. I heard the voice say 1 hour, 25 minutes. Yeah, and I always suspected that these things were erected and existed for other reasons that we don't know about. I mean, they definitely could broadcast very, very far. They were very powerful. You know, if you think about it as it's a short wave radio in essence that's sending a massive signal out. Very cool thing though. You know, very, very interesting, very creepy, and also something that could start a conspiracy theory. You know, it's like one of those things like, what is this gigantic structure? You know, so if you want to learn more about it, you could just look up the Duga over the horizon radar and you could read more about that. So I have a new Noisy this week, guys. This Noisy was sent in by a listener named Jacques Hemming, and he said his name is pronounced Jake, not Jacques. I just saw that.
I read that after.
Yeah, I kind of did. Thank you, Jake. But why would you spell your name that way? But anyway, I like Jacques, but Jake, you know, Jake is a cool name. Anyway, he sent in this Noisy. Very cool. What is that? Somebody might know out there. If you have any idea what this week's Noisy is, or if you want to send me a Noisy, if you want to actually attach the Noisy to an email in a sound file format, just send it to WTN. That's Who's That Noisy? WTN at theskepticsguide.org.
One quick email this week. This is actually a name that logical fallacy. This comes from Robert Tolbert in Dallas, Texas. And Robert writes, I was responding on a video on what would happen to you if you were in outer space. I went to Google and looked up the answer and told the guy to look it up. He wouldn't do it, saying, why should I look it up? It is established science. Is there a logical fallacy that covers this? Thank you very much, Robert Tolbert. All right. What do you guys think? This is a very quick one, but
I don't get it. Can you help me understand what he's saying?
All right. So I guess they were disagreeing about what would happen to you in outer space.
And one guy saying, I know what happens. And the other guy says, no, this is what happens. Look it up. And he goes, why would I look it up? I already know what happens.
Yeah, why should I look it up? It's established science.
To verify that you're remembering it correctly?
I mean, maybe the guy is so familiar with it and he's looked it up so often that he's like, oh, I want to look it up again. I know what the consensus is.
Yeah, I can't tell who's making the error in thinking.
What do you think? That's the question.
I need more context.
Well, I read the whole email.
I know. So. It's like, oh, I don't know.
But let's just say, this is the point at which you could say, if this is the situation, yeah. then this is the logical fallacy. So I think that Robert is trying to say that he disagreed with what the video was saying and looked it up on Google and found that it was different than what the video was saying. Mm-hmm. And the other guy wouldn't listen to him, and wouldn't look it up because he said, why should I look it up? I already know the answer.
So kind of like, I did my research. One dude on the internet told me this is true. Therefore, it's established science.
Well, we don't know why he thinks it's established science. Okay. But that's a reasonable inference, right? That, I mean, if he was wrong, then clearly he didn't look deep enough into the answer. Right. I mean, I think it's kind of a vague conversation on both sides, because just saying... it's kind of tricky when you're telling somebody, just look it up on Google. That I think is a reasonable response to somebody who is like C-lining you or is just trying to be a troll or is a denialist. But if you're having a legitimate conversation, you should give a reference to what you're saying, and just giving Google as the reference isn't really advancing the conversation, but saying, I'm not going to do any further research. I'm locked into what I currently believe, and I'm just going to label it established science, also is invalid. But what's the specific, can we peel out a specific logical fallacy in any aspect?
Yeah, that either of them are committing.
No, we can't.
Sometimes when people say it's just a non sequitur, which is kind of the generic logical fallacy, when it's not even specific enough to be a specific
fallacy.
It's too vague. But I always like to look to see what could be lurking in there. So I think that this is a form of argument from authority, right? He's appealing to the authority of quote unquote established science.
Right.
He's doing it in a very vague and poor way, but. It's kind of like also saying, well, a study shows without giving a reference to this study, or it's even like saying, I heard, or in the future, they will believe this. Like, you could refer to all kinds of different types of authority, the future, science, some vague, reference to a study or whatever.
Right, or just they. That's the one that kills me. I used to have professors that would get on us so bad. Like, who is they? Stop quoting they.
So that's it's not only an argument from authority, it's a vague argument from authority. Like, you're not even being specific about who the authority is, or you're using some nebulous abstract concept as the authority, like science. Well, that's what science says. You're not listening to science.
Yeah.
right. It's the same kind of thing. And then just saying, look it up on Google is, I'm not sure that that's a logical fallacy. It's just not a very effective debating technique or argument or discussion technique. Like, if your goal is to achieve some kind of consensus or common ground, often I'll tell people, I've been in conversations where there's a disagreement over facts. I'm like, let's look it up right now together.
Exactly. And then we can agree if this is a valid source, we can, all those things.
Yeah. Then you get to like, is that a valid source, et cetera. And if you can agree ahead of time, like, let's see what the first four or five, reasonable references have to say about this. If it's something that's not resolvable immediately like that, like a fact, like what was the year this happened or whatever. If it's not something that's a little bit more nuanced, it might be, all right, let's, each do a kind of a deeper dive on this and see what we come up with, and then compare notes, if it's worth it to you. That's a constructive way to move forward. But the thing that always kills me is, like, we have at our fingertips, like, the world's knowledge, like, the collected human knowledge is literally in the palm of our hands. The probably the most important intellectual skill you can have in this day and age is the ability to find information online and know, distinguishing reliable from unreliable.
Yeah, crafting a good Google search term. Sometimes you got to Google what to search by.
Your Google food,
right?
Yeah, often, like, when I'm doing research on something I haven't delved into before, like, my first layer of research is just finding the right research terms.
Yep. Oh yeah, that's a big part of doing scientific research, is when you're looking into the journals, what terms am I looking for? What combination of terms am I looking for? Because you can have blinders to an entire field of inquiry if you didn't look at that one search term that's a That's a synonym. I'm wondering, though, Steve, then that leads me to question, is there a logical fallacy built into the sort of, we've seen the meme going around, right, of like, I did my own research, and then all the footnotes that are like, I watched some dude's, you know, video on YouTube. But this idea of like doing your own research and somehow that as an independent source of inquiry online, you know, just because I found a few videos that reinforce my beliefs, I did my own research.
Yeah. So, I mean, just to be clear, the word research is used in two different ways. And I don't think it's fair to criticize people for saying I did like online research because they weren't in a lab actually reproducing primary science. That's not what anybody means by that. They're referring to literature research, where you're looking at what is out there. You know, in science, we're talking about published peer-reviewed papers, or even presentations at conferences, and you know, there's lots of legitimate scientific resources. That's your literature research. So people are using it to mean literature research. The problem is with, you know, a lot of people who are not formally trained or don't have a lot of experience in science, they think that YouTube is a legitimate, you know, source of information when they're doing their quote unquote literature research. It's just that they're relying upon biased, poor quality, and sometimes just horrific resources for their information, and they're not discriminating because they, you know, have a profound lack of critical thinking skills and media savvy, and so they think that some guy on the internet is a reasonable reference, you know. But the other thing is that, you know, if you're doing like scholarship, like if, you know, there's the principle of, and this is what they mean by don't cite Wikipedia, you should always backtrack to the primary source.
Wikipedia has
not
the
use a secondary source. Yeah, that's the thing. Just go to the links and they'll, and maybe that's, you have to go two or three steps, but get as close as you can or to the primary source if you can, not someone else's interpretation of that. Cause then it's like telephone where there's some kind of filter in between every step of the way. All right, guys, let's go on with the interview. We are joined now by Dr. Brad McKay. Brad, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you for having me, guys.
Yeah.
Now, Brad, you are a general practitioner, a fellow physician, working right now in Sydney, Australia, and you authored a book that came out last year, Fake Medicine, Exposing the Wellness Crazes, Cons, and Quacks Costing Us Our Health. Sounds like
That sounds on brand for you guys.
Sounds on brand, absolutely. Very promising.
Yeah.
Promising.
We put our toe in that water. Yep.
So tell us about the book.
So I work as a general practitioner, which is like a family physician, I suppose, or a family doctor if you're in America. So I sort of specialize in HIV medicine at the moment, but do all sorts of family medicine and sexual health. I decided to write a book in about 2019 and pitched the idea at the end of the year. And then we suddenly had COVID spreading around the world. So I had lots of time at home to sit and type and make sure that I was writing a book and not going out partying. So it was the perfect time to write. But it sort of ended up being a bit of a mismatch of a whole lot of different things in my life. So it's a bit of an autobiography. So a bit of my childhood upbringing in a religious family, me sort of like getting into medicine and having this conflicting world between religion and science. And that was a bit of a battle getting through all of that. And then also having like my own medical problems as well, being diagnosed with a bone tumor, in my back and having my family trying to pray it away, which, spoiler, didn't work. Yeah, no.
Yeah. Spoiler.
So it's, so that's sort of like my friendly start to the book is to sort of like try to get everybody on side, make me sound like really personable and lovely. And then I just like ripped to shreds about a whole lot of, pseudoscience and weird and wacky things that I do come across every day working in general practice.
And so was it more your personal experience or your experience with your patients as a physician that really motivated you to write this book?
It was really my patients. So, I started off like in the hospital, working for a few years, and everything is just evidence based. And then you sort of like leave the hospital, and then you're working in a room by yourself, and you might have a supervisor there, and you're seeing patients one on one, and then they're coming in and like telling you all sorts of weird stuff that you've never actually been taught at all during your medical degree. So like, for example, I remember like one of the first patients I had as a general practitioner was coming in, and her thyroid function was all over the place, and I'm like, what is going on? Like, I've prescribed you thyroxin, but you have no stability with your thyroid. Your metabolism is all over the place. And she said, oh no, I haven't been taking that synthetic stuff that you've been prescribing me that's made in a lab. Like, I'm a vegan, and so I don't want anything toxic in my body. So I've been having thyroid extract from my naturopath. And I was like, have no idea what that is, because I have not been taught that in my training. And so I like looked at, like did a bit of a Google search while she was there in the room. And then I'm there going, like, you're saying that you're a vegan. thyroid extract is made from ground up pig thyroid. So this is no wonder her thyroid function was all over the place, because there's no consistency. They're having capsules of ground up thyroid from animals, and you could have a really high dose, you could have a really low dose, you really don't know. And I'm like wondering, what am I doing wrong as a doctor? Because I'm expecting her to take a standardized dose that I've prescribed her every day. And so this is a disconnect that I find that a lot of doctors have. We sort of don't know what our patients are taking. We don't know what they're twisting, what we're sort of like told them to do or advise them to follow, and then that's twisted in some strange realm. And this is just getting worse with influencers and a lot of social media. There's just a lot more of that has developed over the past sort of 15 years of me being a doctor.
Yeah, it's definitely increasing over time. But it's also interesting that, and it's very typical, like the narrative that people fall for. She's like, yeah, I don't want to take anything synthetic or toxic, so I'm going to take something that is, there's no quality control, that's basically like practicing medicine 200 years ago, right? It's like, let's abandon all modern science, but it's natural. It's like, yeah, and you'll die naturally too. How about that?
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, some of my colleagues will even perform vitamin C infusions, and like for all sorts of different reasons. And like when I'm talking to them, the red lights are going off in my brain, and they're going, I'm sure that was debunked before I was even born. Like, why are we still giving this to patients? You've talked about it before on the show, where people are often given vitamin C infusions as a cancer treatment, and sometimes we've found that that's interacted with their cancer treatment, their chemotherapy. It's inactivated it, and so their cancer actually spreads further and works faster to kill them. And the vitamin C infusion doesn't do anything at all, rather than treating themselves in the foot. Now I have colleagues who are wise to that, and so they know that high dose vitamin C infusions could interact with somebody's chemotherapy. So now they have a low dose, high dose vitamin C therapy for patients on cancer treatment. So it's sort of like this weird way of justifying putting a line into somebody and giving them a bunch of fluid, making it safe. So not proven to do anything, and then adjusting the dose to fit their protocol. It's just really, really wacky across the board. And it's still astounding at what doctors believe that isn't evidence-based.
Yeah, that's a good question. How much of this is patients getting this, on the internet or from naturopaths or other sort of not science-based practitioners? And how much has it infiltrated just general practitioners, just physicians who with a standard medical training?
Yeah, we've gone from like alternative therapy to complementary medicine to then integrative medicine, and so it all sounds like it's integrative, but it's often not evidence based, and there are a lot of like vitamin bottles behind the counter when you're going into the clinic that are being sold. So there is other ulterior motives that are going on. But I was fascinated that GPs can perform acupuncture. There's even like a Medicare code where we can get a rebate for performing acupuncture on our patients, whether that's using needles or if it's waving a laser wand at our patients. We can get funding from the government to do that. And yeah, like we're very much wanting to follow evidence base. The government is wanting to save money and not spend it on things that don't work. But there's clearly this disconnect where there can be a lot of advocacy for complementary therapies. And it seems legit. Your doctor is doing it. They've been taught to do it at a special college. They've got a certificate on their wall showing them that they're trained in that area, but if it doesn't do you any good at all, like this is a major problem. And I think that there is that blurring of lines. And I think we often put it on the patients, but we also need to see what the doctors are doing, and yeah, like what they're actually recommending for their patients and carrying out.
So why is it that you think so many of your colleagues are falling for this?
Well, I don't think it's many of my colleagues. It's probably the ones that I pick on the most, the colleagues that really pop up in my eye. And I started making a list a few years ago of people not to recommend my patients to. But yeah, like part of it is influences from their patients, influences from their family, and yeah, like different training colleges. I think a lot of doctors want to become a bit niche as well, and if they wanting to upskill. And so we as general practitioners, we're very general, of course. So we want to find an area that we can do that our colleagues don't. And so like acupuncture is one of those, intravenous infusions of vitamin C is another, integrative medicine is another. And so it's sort of like, yeah, putting a bit of a brand on what you're doing. And I think often, GPs and other doctors are wanting to be paid a little bit more as well. And so often we're like, doctors' wages were frozen for many, many years in Australia for general practitioners. The government wouldn't increase our wage with inflation. And so often people have been trying to make ends meet. It sounds ridiculous that doctors are like struggling to live, but this is what is sort of like happening a little bit. We're highly qualified, but undervalued. And so if you're able to sell your vitamins on the side or yeah, like put needles in somebody and leave them there for 45 minutes and get paid for it, yay, great. So it is a bit of trying to multitask and multi-skill. But often our critical thinking alarm doesn't go off when we're sort of focused on that extra additional training.
And not everybody has a critical thinking alarm. You know, you can certainly get through medical school and become a competent practitioner without you could be essentially, well-trained technician without being able to think critically. I don't think you can be a good doctor if you do that, but you could certainly be sort of a technically competent doctor, but then you'll fall for all this nonsense, right? Because you're not a critical thinker. You don't know how to distinguish science from pseudoscience. So is this something that because you said yourself, like you were never taught any of this stuff in medical school. Is this a problem then at the medical school level and the training level? Do we need to be incorporating critical thinking and science versus pseudoscience in medical training?
Oh, totally. So the whole issue with sort of alternative medicines and supplements is that we really don't have the education about it. If there's no evidence for it, it's just sort of glossed over in medical school. So we certainly need to know a little bit more about it. I've talked to some of my medical student colleagues at the moment, and asked them, like, what do they know about Chinese medicine? And they just sort of say, oh, I've been taught at medical school that if somebody's on taking Chinese medicine regularly, then check their liver function because it's likely to be crap. So, yeah. That's sort of like their base knowledge. But yeah, we sort of need to be taught that things don't work or to be more knowledgeable about what our patients are using rather than just the things that work. I think there's enough sort of packed into medical training anyway. And I think that's the difficulty. Like why teach garbage to your students, when you're trying to teach them quality things. But this does impact on patient care later on. But like sometimes it is innocent as well. Like I ended up having a chalazion, which is like a weird gland in your eyelid. That doesn't go away. People think that it's a sty, and then keep on putting on hot compresses and it doesn't do anything. So I went to see an ophthalmologist and he said, oh yeah, I've seen all of these chalazions coming in. I reckon it's because everyone's wearing masks. And so all of the breath from their is being directed up and then drying out their eyes and then causing blockages of glands. And then people are getting a chalazion. And I'm like, okay, well, that's really interesting. And then he sent me to an ophthalmic surgeon because I had some weird tricky thing. And he was like, oh, no, that's garbage. Like, no, it's because people are looking at computer screens all the time.
Oh, God.
Because I've got Zoom meetings and Skype. And so they're not blinking their eyes enough. And so that's not clearing the oil from their eyes. And I'm like going, what the hell is going on? Like two high professionals. But like, and this is their anecdotal story. This is their experience as well. So unless you actually like take a big look at everything and look at the science behind it, there could be all sorts of reasons why people are coming in. They could just be bored at home in lockdown and going, oh, I've got this lump in my eye. Maybe I'll deal with it. Like that, like it's exactly. Not necessarily that it's masks or looking at a screen. But yeah, like, and this is what science is about, really sort of like bringing that curtain back and looking at the big picture rather than us being doctors going, oh, I reckon it's this. And I think doctors tend to go into that grind. We sort of, yeah, like have our own experience and come to our own conclusions. But we don't take that next step of going, hey, maybe I'll investigate this further. And sometimes we don't have time to do that. And so we stick to the same rhetoric all the time.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about the regulations in Australia. So if you like have a patient, for example, who tells you some horrific story about somebody who's putting poison under their tongue, what do you do? I mean, is there a way to deal with that in terms of, through government regulation?
Yeah, so certainly there's the medical board. So APRA is in Australia. So you can make a referral or a report. You can make it either anonymously or with your name. Unfortunately, one of my friends ended up reporting a doctor, and then and by accident they actually released their name to the person that they had reported. So the anonymous part of it was a bit of a fail. So that is a bit of a big concern. But yeah, like there should be these anonymous measures in place. And yeah, like the medical board will come in if there's something that's horrendous and is harming patients. They'll step in pretty quickly and they'll stop them from practicing pretty soon. Otherwise they'll put restrictions in place. So certainly recently at the end of last year, there was a doctor down in Melbourne who was starting up an ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine clinic. Providing that as protection against COVID for all of his patients. And certainly the government came in pretty quickly and said, no, you cannot practice. There was another doctor who was writing like hundreds and hundreds of vaccine exemption certificates for patients to get them out of having COVID vaccines because it was a requirement in Australia, particularly if you're trying to work in different organizations, you're needing to be vaccinated. And so he was stopped from working. It turned out that he was in his 80s and had been brought back from retirement. And so he just went back into retirement. But yeah, that was his addition to Australian society, writing lots of medical exemption certificates for vaccinations. So yeah, there are checks and balances, but sometimes it just doesn't work. And people, if they are providing vitamin C infusions or selling lots of vitamins, it's sort of like, well, is that enough to report somebody? Like, yeah, like you've got to have something pretty catastrophic to really spike people's interest and make the authorities pay attention.
We're still getting, Steve, did you see even just yesterday, I think we got an email from a listener saying, you know, my relative's doctor wrote them a script for hydroxychloroquine for COVID. Like, that's still happening here all the time.
Yeah, it is.
Ugh.
Yeah, that has the extra layer of being politicized.
So, we sort of see the political divide that's happening in America. Like, overall, like, Australians are very much on board. So more than 95% of the population here is vaccinated against COVID. Like, we've got phenomenally successful immunization rates. It is mandated in some states, mainly Victoria. But yeah, like the rest of the country, it's not mandated. But yeah, like we love vaccinating. There are a few loud voices and there are many protests that have happened over time. And it seems to be a culmination. It's sort of like QAnon followers and anti-vaxxers mixed in with Free the Children signs. And yeah, like there's all sorts of different people who all are coming together to form these crowds.
Yeah, the remnants.
And some of them are vaccinated, and they're protesting against vaccination, which is interesting. But yeah, we also have we've recently had Novak Djokovic as well. Did you guys hear that story?
Yeah, big story.
We know all about
what a train wreck.
Oh my God! Yeah.
Well, he has a very long history of some terrible anti-science, quackery, pseudoscience. It's no surprise that he's gone down that path.
Yeah, like there were quite a few stuff ups from the government, of course, with the immigration, like multiple levels of failure. The final ruling was saying, he won't get his visa to come and play in a major tennis tournament in Australia, mainly because he wasn't vaccinated. And it was sort of like trying to twist the boundaries of the rules. So if we are sort of sticking to the rules, you need to be vaccinated to come in, even if you have had COVID, that's not an excuse. That's not a medical exemption to come into the country. You need to be vaccinated. And so I can understand, like, if we're sticklers for the rules in Australia. So it was, there. But there was also talk about him having anti-vaccination sentiment. And so we're not wanting him to be successful coming into the country because we are wanting people to be vaccinated. And we've currently gone into Code Brown in Victoria, where basically the hospitals are in meltdown. It's like if you've got an earthquake or fire, like bushfire, if you've got a flood, these are all sort of code browns. And so we've got this COVID code brown that's happening at the moment. So very, very touchy in Victoria. So understandable. By all in all, like I think we're getting better at stopping anti-vaxxers from having airtime on the radio and television and having that false balance. So a lot of people are saying, oh, well, it's just my side of things. It's just my point of view. And I need equal time to talk about this. And it's on the radio and in the media. And so we're getting better in Australia at coming back to them and saying, no, you don't. You have like 5% of the time, maybe. the vast majority of people are actually against what you're standing for. And so we do want to plow on and protect as many people as possible.
It's funny, just as an aside, Code Brown means something very different in America.
Code Brown, like, gotta exit the room quickly.
We have like a code blue. Like, code blue is like somebody having a heart attack and you need the team there. So it's just a joke where we say, like, yeah, there's a Code Brown in room 10, so the nurse needs to go clean things up.
Yeah.
We have Code Black as well, where there's like a threat. Ugh. So somebody's picking a fight in the emergency department. So that's everyone runs down for a Code Black and doesn't really want to go there. Code Brown, yeah.
All right, well, Brad, this has been a lot of fun. We're glad that Australia has somebody like you, you know, carrying the banner for science and reason and medicine. You know, who would have thought we would have to fight for medicine to be based on like evidence and logic and science.
I know, trying to convince people to improve their health and to get vaccinated and protect themselves from potentially lethal disease. It's a weird battle. This is what we've been saying previously, is that, people often just go on their own route. They'll do their own research online. They're getting bad advice. Yeah, they become experts in their own rabbit hole, I suppose.
So we are
getting better, and we're getting better at addressing these issues, and trying to identify that this is happening. So identifying the misinformation, identifying disinformation, and doing something about it. So I'm very hopeful for the future. I'm very hopeful that doctors will be able to take more note of what our patients are doing and not just sort of go, oh yeah, something TCM, don't know. We're really needing to drill down, and that's the only way of really getting rid of a lot of the pseudoscience, by explaining that to our patients and really trying to be clear about what's good and what's healthy and what's just fake medicine.
Yeah, totally agree. I get the biggest problem I encounter on my end is the shruggy problem, is people who are just like, meh, you know, what's the big deal? You know, even physicians, like, they don't see the threat this poses. And I don't get it. I don't know why they're not outraged, you know?
Yeah, but Steve, sometimes I think, man, who cares about the druggies?
Oh <my God>.
All right, Brad, thanks a lot. Thanks for joining us. Keep fighting the good fight down under.
Same to you guys up over. Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Take care.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake-a-rooney. You guys ready? We have a sort of a theme. This is three news items, but there's a technology theme to the items. These are all alleged advances in technology. Okay, item number one. Scientists report on a new rapid test for SARS-CoV-2 that requires only minutes and has a near 100% sensitivity compared to 94% sensitivity for the rapid PCR test, which takes several hours. Item number two, researchers have developed a brain surface sensory array with 2,048 sensors, more than 10 times the density of those currently in use. And item number three, Nature reports on three separate teams who have demonstrated greater than 99% accuracy in silicon quantum computing systems, essentially removing a major obstacle to the technology.
I want all of those things to have happened.
Well, then why don't you go first, Jay?
I'll go first. Okay, this first one here. Now, there are scientists who are reporting that the new rapid test for SARS-CoV-2, they say it requires only minutes and has near 100%. Okay, that's all right, so if this is true, Steve, what you say, if this is true, it'd be great. It would be fantastic. I see no reason to disbelieve any of this, right? I don't know the mechanism on how the PCR test completely functions, meaning I don't know why it takes so long to get the results. I just assumed it was backlog. But maybe it needs to sit there and percolate for a little while for it to do its thing. I don't know. But I don't see a reason why that's, you know, I shouldn't believe that. I like that one. So it's definitely going to be between 2 and 3 for me. So researchers have developed a brain surface sensory array. Now, we've heard about these before. These are Steve, can I ask, is this the kind that they actually put right on top of your brain inside your skull?
That's right.
It is. Okay. This is a big deal. I've seen and read, you know, quite a bit about these. They literally have to put it right on top of your brain and touch. It's touching the surface of your brain.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I'm not surprised by this. Of course, they're going to continue to advance that technology. We know Elon Musk has money invested in stuff like this as well, which means that there's just money happening at it. So sure, they increased the amount of sensors by an order of magnitude. I don't find that hard to believe. You know, I'm sure that at some point, the size is going to matter because you only have so much surface to your brain, and who the hell knows exactly where they need to put those things. But okay, let's go to the last one here. Nature reports on three separate teams who have demonstrated 99% accuracy in silicon quantum computing systems. Silicon quantum computing systems. That's the part that got me when you first read it. I didn't realize that quantum computing systems were relying on silicon. I don't know. I might be just super ignorant right now. I've read quite a bit about these. We actually wrote a chapter about quantum computing in our book. So, okay. So what's the thing, Steve? The silicon component is now, they're saying it's 99% accurate.
Yes. The accuracy is the new bit. It is what's
right.
The
accuracy.
Yeah.
Do they always use silicon for quantum computing?
No, but if you do, it makes it easier to interface them with existing computers.
Right. That's what, you know, okay, that's cool. All right, so 99% accuracy. I think this is the fake. I think this one is the fake. It seems kind of obvious because this is a leap forward, a giant leap forward, if I'm recalling things correctly, about where we're at today. That I think one of the big problems was the accuracy. So 99% is really, really fantastic. So I'm going to say this one's the fake.
Okay, Evan.
The first one about the new test, 100% sensitivity, and in only minutes, when you compare that to 94% sensitivity and taking several hours, that seems like a leap, you know, quite the leap, especially regarding the time. I mean, several hours to minutes, that's pretty big. But I do think that one's going to turn out to be science. There's been so much going on with COVID testing. And trying to find new and better ways to test that I'm not surprised that they've made significant advances in a relatively short amount of time. The one with the brain surface sensory array, I have no clue. You know, really wish Kara went before me on this one. I'll just say that. But more than 10 times the density of those in current use, order of magnitude, okay. But again, I have no information on this. But the one, I think, for a lot of the reasons sort of Jay pointed out, I think I'm going to go with him on the silicon quantum computing system one about being that one being the fiction. And from some things I know Bob has reported on in news items in recent months and years, that this would be a huge leap to have just sort of come out and announced now. I think they were looking at a timescale of something like this much further later in the decade, at least. So I think this one's the fiction as well.
Okay, Kara?
I definitely think it's between the rapid test and the quantum computing, because these are both like, was there a major leap forward in technology. I guess the brain interface one is too, but that one does seem like, yeah, 2040. It's just like they added more sensors, right? Like, I'm sure that was a big technological problem, but it was scalability. Let's just add more sensors and figure out how to do that and get more, I guess, resolution. That seems reasonable. The other two, I just don't think I know enough about it. But I don't know why the COVID test is the one that feels fishier to me. Why would we think that we would have somehow solved both of those problems in the same fell swoop, made it faster and more sensitive? Wouldn't one of those things have been worked out first? I don't know. That one's the fishy one to me. So I'm going to say it's the rapid test that's the fiction.
Okay. And Bob?
Yeah. Well, I agree with most about the 2048 sensors, 10 times the density. Fine. That's totally not surprising. The other two, I guess, are the quantum one. I guess the thing is not the accuracy, because conventional quantum systems, you know, they're about, you know, at 1%, you know, error correction. The key though is to get them to, you know, 0.00001%. That's when you really going to see real amazing stuff. But I guess the big thing here is that you've got a silicon quantum system that is basically at par with conventional quantum computers in terms of error correction. So I guess that's pretty big. And I haven't looked at them too closely, but I guess, yeah, interfacing them with regular computers would be obviously much more convenient. Regarding number one, though, the SARS-CoV-2 test, only minutes. That's big. That's super fast and crazy sensitive. I mean, that's gold. That's a holy grail of that crap. What more could you want except one that's instant? I mean, minutes, go take a pee, come back, and here's your answer. I'm going to go with Kara, SARS-CoV-2, say that's fiction.
Mm. Well, thanks, Bob.
You know, I did research the quantum article with Steve, so.
All right, so you all agree with number two, so we'll start there. Researchers have developed a brain surface sensory array with 2,048 sensors, more than 10 times the density of those currently in use. You all think this one is science. Did I sweep you guys this week? And this one is science. Nope, no sweep.
No sweep.
Okay. Yep, this is science. This is pretty cool. So obviously this is a technology we've been following on the show for years.
Yeah, man.
And this is a pretty nice incremental advance, you know? And it's not so much that there's more electrodes.
Order of magnitude to density.
Yeah, it's the density.
Nice incremental leap.
It's the density. As I say, it's still not a transformational technology. It's just
true.
Doing what we've been doing, but better. But it's just a big one. You know, it's a big incremental advance.
Okay, yes.
And again, it's not just more and more electrodes. It's that they're much more densely packed. So you get, as Kara said, use the magic word resolution. This gives super high resolution. The ones that are currently in use are more like 64 sensors. Between 16 and 64. This is, you know, between 1024 and 2048. So it is more than an order of magnitude greater. Now there are some like research grids that can get up to 256, but they're not, you know, currently in use outside of research. These are the ones that like a surgeon would put on your brain to see exactly where your seizure is, so they could then take out that part of the brain, right? So resolution is key. This is a technology that is currently in use for neurosurgery. And so
what's the area though, Steve? What's the area that the 2048? Is it a small area or is it a really big area?
No, it's pretty small.
Like how close are they to neuron level granularity?
Oh, orders of magnitude away from that.
That's what I'm waiting for, kids.
Yeah, the thing is, like, it looks like a kind of a wide postage stamp, you know, that kind of size.
Okay, that's still a lot, like a postage stamp size.
Yeah, that's teeny though.
That's what I'm saying. That's still a lot of stuff packed into a small.
Oh yeah, yeah, it's a high
space.
Density. Yeah, yeah, it's not a few more big though.
Yeah, a few more leaps like that, and we'll be really cooking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
true, but we would have to actually get better at like our surgical technology at that point. Like, it's not really helpful to have something that's super, super resolved if we can't even get to that part of the brain or.
Yeah, I mean, as long as, again, this is on the surface, we're already doing microsurgery, so that's not that big a
deal.
That's true. But you're right, it's the deep structures that are still difficult. And sometimes, like, if a seizure is originating in a deep structure, we might even miss it on the scalp surface electrodes. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't even show up.
I want a supercomputer on every damn neuron and eating wow. glial cell, all wirelessly interconnected. Yep. Done. Game over.
That's all good. Yeah. Very good. All right, let's go back to number one. Scientists report on a new rapid test for SARS-CoV-2 that requires only minutes and has a near 100% sensitivity compared to the 94% sensitivity for the rapid PCR test, which takes several hours. Bob and Kara, you think this one is the fiction. Jay and Evan, you think this one is science. And
Kara, hold my hand.
Is the fiction.
God dang it.
Nice. High five.
So the news item that inspired this fiction is because I read the headline. It's like new, like rapid, you know, COVID test using AI. You're like, okay, this is interesting. Let me look at that. But it turns out it's not like a screening test. This is if you have pneumonia, they use artificial intelligence to look at your chest X-ray and distinguish COVID pneumonia from other kinds of pneumonia.
Uh-huh. And, okay, that's pretty cool.
Yeah,
though.
That's totally yeah. cool. It is. It's very, very cool. But I had to make something of the fiction, so I said, all right, we'll just pretend it's an actual screening test. And give it numbers that are kind of unrealistic, you know, that, yeah, as Kara pointed out, it's like, this would be the holy grail of COVID testing. And then it's the near 100% sensitivity. That's, I think, the hardest part. The, both, you know, the PCR test is like almost 100% specific. Like if it's positive, you're positive. But if it's negative, it's only 94%
that
you don't have it. Yeah.
Oh, gotcha. Okay. And then it's like, it's even worse for the rapid antigens.
It's even worse. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those are like sub 90%.
Yeah. Basically, if you pass them, you're not shedding, but you may still have it and you may be shedding in a few hours.
There's also technique if you're not getting enough of your mucus on the Q-tip and doing everything correctly. And it's just, it may fail, you know, whatever. It's not 100%. All of this means that Nature reports on three separate teams who have demonstrated greater than 99% accuracy in silicon quantum computing systems, essentially removing a major obstacle to the technology. That is science.
That's cool. It's good news, Jay.
Very cool. It is good news.
Thank you.
So what they're doing
nice try, Bob.
Is the quantum unit that they're using is two nuclei that are entangled through an electron. And that electron can you could essentially interface with that electron, and you can also entangle it with another pair of neutrons if you want to.
Well, where does the silicon come in?
And then build, I guess it's in a silicon quantum nano computer chip. Mm-hmm. It's got quantum and nano in the same thing, Bob.
That sounds like a hybrid.
It's a hybrid.
It's three different teams were, you know, using this technology and reported on their findings, each with slightly different rates of error, but they're all greater than 99%, like 99 point, whatever, 0.8, 0.7, 0.4. A little bit more with two qubits than with one qubit. So again, we'll have to see how well it scales. And Bob, you're right. I think we're still... this is an important proof of concept and sort of taking us in potentially a new direction with quantum computing. But we do need to get that error rate a couple of orders of magnitude lower than that, down into the range where you can do the error correction. We'll be able to keep up with the errors. But in interfacing with silicon, since we use silicon computers basically to do the error correction, that apparently is a huge feature of this new approach.
Cool. As soon as you said that, Bob, I was like, we got this. Yeah. As soon as you were like, 0.1, not a big deal, 0.0001, now we're cooking.
yeah. But this is like the dirty little secret of quantum computing, that the error rate is the big problem.
It's king. That's king. And even more important than qubits. You know, you could have a small amount of qubits. If you've got like no error correction, if you've got 100% error correction, you are golden. You are good. It's a huge thing. If we can't tame that, we are not going to go anywhere.
I need some science or fiction error correction. I'm off to a rough start this year.
All right. Well, I'll help you with that, Evan. You are wrong. Wrong, sir.
You get nothing. Good day, sir.
Good day. All right, Evan, you do get to give us a quote.
I do. So at least I have that. Nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution. Ooh. Theodosius Dobzhansky.
Yeah. That's a really classic quote.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
I love that.
I'm kind of surprised we haven't used it already. I guess it was too obvious. But
yeah. Or if we did it 15 years ago, who cares? We're using it again.
Yeah, I wasn't here. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, if we did, it was definitely PC, pre-Kara.
Yeah, it's actually the title of an article he wrote back in 1973. And it's a cool article. Basically, you know, attacking creationism.
It says it all.
It's completely true. You can't understand why biological systems work the way they do, how they develop the way they do, you know, unless we accept within the evolutionary paradigm. It's like so. Yeah. It has incredibly powerful, you know, explanatory capability
and predictive.
It is the substrate upon which it is all built.
Yep, absolutely.
And understood.
All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Of course.
Thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.